Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. With us now is emergency room physician Michelle Harper, who has a new memoir called The Beauty in Breaking. Dr. Harper has been chief resident at Lincoln Hospital in the Bronx, served at the Veterans Affairs Medical Center in Philadelphia, and more. Besides her book, Dr. Harper wrote an article on Medium about the stress of constant intubations and PPE shortages during the coronavirus pandemic. That article is called When This War Is Over, Many of Us Will Leave Medicine. Dr. Harper, thank you for your writing and your time today. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Can I ask you right off the bat about the title of your book, The Beauty in Breaking? How do you mean breaking in that title?
You know, and I reference in there, in the beginning, a Japanese art form. And if I mispronounce the name, I apologize. But Kintsukuri, and in that practice, when a piece of pottery or art is broken, that pottery is repaired by an amalgam of precious metals. So the breaks are actually highlighted, because the thinking is that it's more beautiful after the mending. And I mean that in the same way with human beings. I never romanticize trauma, but that we're all going to have difficulties in life. This is just part of the deal. But in the process of healing, we can become more resilient, stronger, and we can go on to help other people. And for me, that is beautiful.
Is that both about yourself as well as the patients you see in the emergency room?
Definitely. The book demonstrates our interconnectedness in that way.
You describe in the book, for example, the time you went to the emergency room with your brother as a teenager and first got the idea that you might want to work in a place like that for your profession. It was also a very intense moment, I'll alert the listeners, in the life of your family. Can you tell our listeners some of that difficult story, because it seems pivotal to your decisions about your life?
Right. And that was one story. So I grew up in an abusive home with a batterer for a father. So there was always violence, and if not actual violence, then the threat of violence. And so I speak about one incident where my brother was, in an effort to protect my mother, began to fight with my father, and he had him pinned to the ground at one point. And my father bit my brother's hand. And for me, and it was a deep bite, and it stuck with me. I mean, I was young at the time, and I thought to myself that I didn't have the words, but I had the feeling that This is a person I'm related to. This is supposed to be my father and my brother's father also. And if he's capable of such a brutal act, like willing to maim someone, what does that mean? We are not safe, and anything is possible. So that is an incident that, like many, that stuck with me, that formed me, and that had me feel that there wasn't safety in my home, and that I wanted to be part of a structure to help other people moving forward.
Because that time in the emergency room, in that part of the story, you saw a sense of order, a sense of service. Am I putting the right words on it?
Yeah, I think so. Order in a very chaotic place.
Yeah.
Where all people from all walks of life, like children brought in by a parental figure, older people brought in by ambulances, unconscious in cardiac arrest, homeless people who just trying to get some respite from the elements. Everyone comes here seeking something, seeking some way of feeling better, getting better. And that I could relate to that. And it appealed to me that that might be possible somewhere.
And also in that part of the book about your growing up, you describe an earlier family fight when you were a tween, I think, and called 911. Yeah. And the police came and couldn't figure out whether to arrest your father or your brother and wound up leaving without making sure you and your mother were okay, you describe it as.
Right.
And it seems so relevant now that the city and the country are discussing whether the police are the right people to respond to domestic disputes, even ones involving violence. And I'm curious if having lived through what you did as a child and now with an ER doctor's experience, do you have an opinion about what kinds of reform in that area are needed?
Oh my gosh. We need many reforms. First of all, in that situation with the police, for example, I mean, they just need systemic change. I mean, it wasn't difficult to figure out the dynamic there. And could they have been helpful? Yes. But that just depends on their level of insight and their intentions. In terms of violence against women, I mean, where to begin? That has to do with how we're socialized in our society with treating people with dignity and respect, addressing the pay wage gap, addressing, I mean, this we could go on. This is going to take reform on multiple levels in society, structural change.
Sure. And I guess I'm curious with your perspective, you know, through that story and working in the ER where you have contact with people who are brought in by the police, et cetera, whether you have a particular take on police reform and whether there's a way, as we debate in New York and elsewhere, as you know, defunding parts of the NYPD and moving and other police forces and moving those functions with respect to domestic violence is the example that I'm thinking of into other agencies. I'm just curious if you have an opinion whether that's doable.
I do believe it's doable. I mean, I'm sure we'd need policy experts on and people who are experts in finances, but yes, I do. And having worked in, well, mainly I always work in inner city environments with, and having to collaborate with, for example, Child Protective Services that are underfunded and don't have enough staff who need help in order to follow up with families and provide them with resources. Yes, there are organizations that could use the funds where police work wouldn't be relevant, but they're often called to fill in the gaps.
When you were on Weekend Edition with Scott Simon recently, I know you described a situation you write about in your book in which the police brought in a man in handcuffs under arrest to the emergency room, and the police said he had swallowed drugs, I guess to hide them is the implication, and they wanted you to get them out of his body against his will. Could you describe that incident again for us and why racial justice became a factor in your decision about what to do?
Yes, well, so it was as you said, a man brought in police custody, swallowing drugs to hide them, and was the allegation. So clinically, and this is important, the patient was fine. He was not clinically intoxicated. There was no signs of altered mental status, nothing. The patient didn't want any evaluation or treatment of any kind, although it wasn't clear he needed any treatment. And any patient who comes into the ER has that right as long as they're competent medically. And he was. So, but the police wanted it done anyway. And staff in the hospital told me that they often, if that's what the police want, they just do what they want. And the rights of a patient are disregarded in those contexts. And what struck me was that this was, in the department at that time, the patient and I were the two darkest people. I was the only black doctor. And in terms of the police and the nurses, and my resident, who I was training, they were all white at that time. And then the resident called the hospital. I was going to discharge him. The resident called administration in the hospital, the medical legal department, to see if she could override my decision, even though I'm the attending. I'm the doctor in charge. And they alerted her that actually she can't because I'm right, and as I had told her and the police, it would be illegal, not only unprofessional and unethical, but illegal to force an exam on this patient. It would be assault. So he was discharged. So the reason it was relevant is because it not only was it that the patient was presumed to have no personal sovereignty, no bodily integrity. It didn't matter what he wanted. We were supposed to override that. But the medical institution was complicit in that. And my resident felt that I didn't have the authority either to make that decision. So that story highlights many things, and one of them is racial injustice.
Yeah, and you write in the book in various ways about being an African-American woman in a job typically filled by white men, emergency room physician, and that story is one example of your background informing your work. Not to overgeneralize in this question, but do you think some of the white men in the field have certain blind spots that are common, which, you know, would be some of the reasons for the need to diversify the profession?
Yes. I can answer that quickly. Yeah. 100%. Yeah.
Good. Now you have to give me examples. Yeah. Go ahead.
Okay. And we're seeing it play out. You know, I talk about Ford in a lot of different ways, and actually an interview that answers this in more depth just came out in people.com yesterday. Uh-huh. But for example, I was going for a hospital position. It's not uncommon. We work clinically in the ER as emergency medicine physicians, but we'll often get involved in administration as well. I was going for a position in the hospital, and I was the only applicant, but I found out that they decided they weren't going to hire me for it. And my boss, the emergency room director, called me in and said, you know, I'm so sorry. You were the only applicant and you were super qualified, but they decided just to leave it open. And then he told me that he's never able to get women or people of color promoted in the hospital. They just won't ever do it. And that's why they always leave. And he hopes that I will stay on with him anyway, because maybe one day it'll be different. Mm. I did end up leaving. And I found out from colleagues not long after that they hired a white male nurse for the position. Mm. So these are examples. And that's just one
example. And a nurse, not even a doctor.
Nope. No.
That's a tough one, because your supervisor there was, it's an infuriating one. Your supervisor there was choosing to enable the racism of the higher-ups rather than confront it.
Yeah, yes, and that happens all the time. That's not his effort, if I can call it that, to hire. I mean, he did hire women and people of color, that's true. But when it came down to really fighting for justice in that way within the system, it only went that far, which is not far enough.
My guest, if you're just joining us, is emergency room physician Dr. Michelle Harper, who has a new memoir called The Beauty in Breaking. Listeners, we can take a few phone calls for Dr. Harper. Maybe other black MDs want to call in and share your experiences that might echo or add to the stories we've just been talking about. Maybe anyone has a question about any aspect of being an ER doc during COVID or at any time, or whatever you may have for Dr. Michelle Harper, 646-435-7280, 646-435-7280. If I may ask about the present, news headlines today are about ICUs now filling to capacity in Florida and Texas, a situation that had fallen out of the news since we were in that situation or close to it at hospitals in New York. And it makes me furious just watching as a journalist and as a human being, because it seems like this wave was preventable. But may I ask what you are thinking as an emergency room physician?
I do feel the same. I mean, it is it's infuriating and it's heartbreaking. And I'm in the Northeast and I practice in New Jersey. And yes, our people aren't as sick. The numbers of patients aren't as high, but we still are bracing because the behaviors we're seeing in Florida, Texas, we're seeing those behaviors here too. And people are getting restless. They're tired of it. They're posting pictures on social media of them meeting up with their friends and going to the beach and having barbecues. So those behaviors are happening here, and we're bracing for spikes in acuity and in volumes. And we're gonna have to see. And is it preventable? Yes, it's preventable. Would it be even more preventable if there was a coordinated national, federal response, that we had enough tests and equipment and tracing? All those things are true too. So it's a multifactorial failure, truthfully.
Do you feel like you're watching public health priorities compete with economic or with ideological priorities?
Yes, and mainly ideologic, because at least on a national level, we have the resources to prevent this. So it's really disappointing, to say the least.
We'll continue in a minute with Dr. Harper and take some of your calls that are coming in. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with emergency room physician Michelle Harper, who has a new memoir called The Beauty in Breaking. And we will also get to her article on Medium called When This War Is Over, Many of Us Will Leave Medicine, the war being the war against coronavirus. I lost track having read so much mm-hmm. about your history in the book and your bio. You just said you're practicing currently in New Jersey. Where do you work?
Oh, I know. I don't say where I work.
Oh, you don't
kind
have
of
to.
On, yeah, but it's in New Jersey.
Gotcha. Local girl. Jennifer in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with Dr. Harper. Hello, Jennifer.
Yes, good morning, and thank you for taking my call. Dr. Harper, you know, I'm struck by the fact that you grew up, obviously, in acute dysfunction and violence, mm-hmm. and not only did you choose to become a healer physician, but you chose to focus in emergency medicine, i.e. working with people in crisis. Mm. Have you addressed the fact through this extraordinary mechanism of reaction formation that you took such a painful and difficult past and channeled it in an extraordinarily positive and productive way?
And have I addressed the fact? I'm sorry, could you just clarify what the question is?
I mean, in the sense that, I mean, generally speaking, people with significant abuse histories stand mm-hmm. a very good chance of becoming abusive themselves.
Oh, yeah.
And instead, you took this background and, you know, manifested it in an extraordinarily positive and productive mm-hmm. way.
Are you asking
yeah,
how?
Thanks.
Well, she's impressed and
okay, thank you. No, I agree, and I do appreciate the fact that it can go either way. And people, I feel, and what I've seen is they can either learn and heal from that trauma and then, you know, go on to do positive work, or yes, reenact it and recreate those cycles of violence in their life. I mean, certainly my father had a lot of loss in his background, not having a father figure and losing his mother early. And so, yes, that would be an example where he didn't heal from it. He recreated the trauma, and that's common. But it was important to me to not do that. So I did a lot of work on myself so that I would heal and break the cycle.
Jennifer, thank you. Steve in Queens, you're on WNYC with Dr. Michelle Harper. Hi, Steve.
Oh, thank you very much for taking mm-hmm. my call, and good morning to you both. I wanted to say to her, thank you very much for what you're doing and for what you tried mm-hmm. to do at that hospital. As I explained to the screener, I said it happened in 87, but, you know, the feelings are still there, hatred, anger. I was in Central Park to meet up with some friends, and I walked over to two cops in a van to ask for directions. Anyway, all of a sudden, put your hands on the whatever.
Mm.
They called back up when I didn't do it, and they attacked me. I was then taken to Metropolitan Hospital, for which there was a nurse who had a working relationship with them, and she immediately became a cop. She started cursing me like them. She was, you know, carrying on. And when I told her I'm not a criminal and don't care to be treated this way, she shot me full of Haldol and Benadryl and left me there burning up in 90-something degree weather in that hospital. And when they called my mother to come down there, who's long, she's gone now, but they called my mother to come down there, and when they found out, I later found this out after I sued them, when they found out that I was not on parole, I had no criminal record, when the cops, when my mother showed up, every last one of them were gone, including the nurse. Everyone was gone. They were out of that room. So, you know what I'm saying? It was, the feeling was that what I later found out was, well, they thought they were looking for a person in Central Park with a gun, and I was acting cool, for which I asked the cop, this was some time later, I heard Sammy Davis and Miles were in New York at the same time. Did you also grab them too?
Steve, I hear your story, and Dr. Harper, without, you know, knowing all the details or other people's sides of that story, I'll bet that has echoes of things you run into as
of
an
course.
Emergency room physician in the city.
In it cities. Does. It does, and it is disgusting. And thank you for sharing that. It's horrific to hear. And that's why I bring up the fact that, and yes, in ERs, we do have, typically, most ERs, and I trained in New York City, and I could certainly say when I was at Lincoln, and there was a police precinct there, at least at the time, we had a close working relationship with the police. And the police in the hospital, it was actually really positive, you know, 9 times out of 10. But then there were other times when it wasn't. But it's our job as medical professionals to not be complicit. That's our job. I don't care if it's the police bringing someone in, their family member. It is our job to stand up for the welfare of the patient and the larger community and justice. And a failure to do so is a failure of this a system. And part of the reason why I tell that story about Dominique is that it's an example of where the police were wrong and the medical institution is wrong, and both need to be addressed. Because the story you tell, sadly, is far too common, and it can't be ignored. The story must be amplified and corrected.
Steve, thank you for sharing it with us.
Thank you.
We have a few minutes left. Your article on Medium was back in April. When this war is over, many of us will leave medicine, and it's a compelling but difficult read for the illness of the nursing home patient you describe and your own uncertainty about whether your PPEs were sufficiently protecting you and your colleagues. Do you think that the scene you describe of having to reuse your contaminated N95 has been resolved as an issue in this country, at least that, by now?
No. Definitely not. If anything, it's worse. There are still shortages. We've had donations, which are helpful. Donations from companies, so we have a nicer face shield now. They're in limited supply, so we guard them and keep them very safe. And it's one. Like, I have one face shield. That's the one I've been using. In terms of N95, they've developed a recycling program. None of us. This isn't a new standard, though. We would never be allowed to reuse our masks. They would never be recycled before. But now they're sent out. There's some kind of treatment. We're not refitted for them. We don't know if they still fit properly. And this is just how it is. There are fewer cases at this time, we think. I say we think because we still can't test everyone because we don't have enough tests. But even with this kind of stopgap measure, we don't know what will happen in the fall, for example, if that's when the spike is. We don't know if it's going to happen before, but we don't know. Mm-hmm. Our resources are already strained. So what will happen when there are even more cases? So no, it's not better.
Have you followed the issue since your article revolved so much around the story of a nursing home patient who was brought to the hospital who you were treating? You know, many nursing home deaths in New York State after the transfer of COVID patients back to their nursing homes when they were then well enough for that in order to clear the hospital beds, which was very important, but with the risk of bringing contagious people back into those nursing homes. Do you think there was an alternative to those awful choices?
Now, in terms of discharging people from the hospital who were safe to discharge, there was no alternative to that. There just wasn't, because we didn't, at the height of it, we lacked the space to take care of people.
Yeah,
so
you needed the beds.
That there was no alternative to. I mean, on a community level, on a community level, I don't know exactly what the solution are. I don't know what the resources, if there could have been hotels rented or like vacated and used for that reason to space people out. I will tell you another population where it was just awful seeing the extent of disease, the severity of the disease, and the treatment of people is in prisons. That was another population, and that was heartbreaking for me to see what was happening there and how young, healthy people were being just devastated by this illness. And that didn't have to be the case. You know, whoever doesn't, and that's a larger discussion on the carceral state, but certainly whoever doesn't need to be in prison, which is many people, nonviolent offenders, they should have been released. And we could have prevented disease and mortality there.
Why do you say, to the title of your article, that after this war against COVID, many of you will leave medicine? Why wouldn't it be a horrible war finally over when that day comes and things can go back to the hard enough old normal?
Well, so this is in a larger context of the business of medicine becoming increasingly demoralizing to providers, where there's less time to actually take care of patients. In America, unfortunately, the focus is on billing and profit making for whatever institution or group you work for, and it's less about wellness and health. So there was already this movement towards people leaving medicine. And now we have this crisis, and during this crisis, we were treated as more disposable than our equipment. That just exacerbates the feeling, and I do think more people will leave. I mean, am I ready to leave medicine? My personal mission with medicine isn't done, but I'm seeing the effects on my colleagues, and it's becoming less tenable.
I hear. So last question, what's the career path typically of an ER doctor? Is it to do that for your whole career, or do that for a while and then set up more of a practice where you have ongoing relationships with patients, which might be satisfying for someone like you who seems so relationship oriented, but also, you know, just out of the constant trauma of seeing people at the worst moments of their lives?
Right. That is a good question, though. Emergency medicine, that is the specialty. Like, there are some people who are hospitalist doctors, and what they do is they just cover the hospital and work in hospital. So ERs is the same. Our specialty is literally to work in the ER. So that's the job. Now, do some of us go on to work in urgent care, for example, just because it's less stressful? Yes, you don't get a relationship there. You just have a better schedule and less acuity. But that's kind of it. And some people set up like Botox centers, but for the most part, ER is to work in the ER.
ER or Botox Center, or
right,
or something
terrible,
or something right. In between. Michelle Harper has written a memoir called The Beauty in Breaking. Thank you so much for your work. Thank you so much for a wonderful conversation, Doctor.
Thank you. It was wonderful being here.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. More to come.